You're listening to the Fusion Patrol Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene, and tonight Ben's not with us, so Simon has joined us. Welcome, Simon.
Hello. Thank you very much.
And we're just itching to talk to you tonight about The Rebel Flesh and the Almost People, which is written by Matthew Graham and is the latest two-part episode of Doctor Who. Why don't you go first, Simon? What are your initial impressions of this episode?
Well, of course, it was a two-parter, and I like the two-parters, so I'm always keen on that. I have to say, it's often the case with the two-parters that it's the second part that lets it down. But oddly enough, in this case, the first part, I thought, yeah, it's good. It's a good setup episode. It seemed to be treading water a bit towards the end. The second part absolutely delivered in spades, and it pretty much blew my mind. So I think taken as a whole, it was really excellent. In fact, I have to say, because I've been listening to you and Ben discussing the previous episodes in the series, I'm loving this series. I'm absolutely loving this series. It's gone in a completely different direction, I think, from Who before, and this just built on that. It really took the. You can see what. Oh, I don't even know where to start. But you can see where this fits in the series. You can see now what the sort of shorter series, because next week we've got the mid-season finale, as they're calling it, and the way in which the stories are linked together now. It begins to make some sense, the shape of the show in this.
Well, now here's the thing. You've obviously heard, and Ben and I have not been exactly effusive this year on the episodes, and I will say that this two-parter is about as good as it gets, and I don't mean just for this year. I mean, period. I would put this up at the very top of New Who. Maybe not the top, but very high. I thought it was almost perfect. Frankly, it was the right pacing. It was the right length. It had such a wonderful classic Who feel, being in a who would make a acid mining in an old castle? Nobody but an old British TV show. I mean, that's just that's just so classically Doctor Who, and you're right. It fit in with a story arc, and it fit in with a story arc like it ought to fit in with a story arc, not like the other episodes so far that have kind of, ignoring the first two-parter, but the others where, you know, you just get the peephole open up and Amy sees the patch lady, or they kind of have a little heart-to-heart and the TARDIS, no, you can't tell him, he's going to die, kind of stuff. I mean, this you didn't see it as part of the story arc. It didn't. You know, it was self-contained, it was complete, and then it's like, boop, all of a sudden it makes sense. That was perfect. I mean, that was just absolutely, that's the way they ought to do the story arcs, in my mind, because when they're beating you over the head with it, quite so obviously, I even thought they were beating us over the head with it, with a couple of the, you know, the doors opening up with the eye patch lady, but then suddenly, you know, just, it was well done, and I'm impressed, because it wasn't written by Moffat, so he let someone else do a critical piece of the story, of the arc. That was kind of a surprise.
Yeah, although I mean, it stands alone as a story. I think it works in its own right. But I certainly don't disagree with you about the quality of this one. I mean, I did think it was an absolutely excellent two-parter. I'm pleased to hear you say that, obviously, given that I think you may have underrated some of the previously excellent shows in this particular series. But I do think the difference is, like you say, it is how it fits into the story arc And I think that has been a thing in this series. Some of the previous episodes, it's not that I've thought they're the best Who of all time, but when you have a great story, comes along, and it tends to be a great standalone episode. Genesis of the Daleks, The Empty Child, The Girl in the Fireplace, Blink, Midnight, they're all brilliant stories, but they're one-offs. Whereas these stories in this series, perhaps I wouldn't have put any of them that high up in the rankings, but I would say as a continuing storyline, as the show has sort of developed from week to week, it just has kicked it up a notch as a show, as in terms of how it hangs together.
Mm-hmm. And in this one, and I want to say frequently, we'll come back to it, because I have it in my notes to make sure that we come back to it. But I mean, not only did this one kick the rug out from under you towards the end there about the nature of what's been going on, but I think there's another shoe that's going to fall pretty soon about that too, because I think there's another piece that hasn't necessarily been noticed, but and it's an important piece, and I think it'll make this story even bigger than previously.
Is it shoe related?
It's not shoe related. It has to do with Amy. Well, let's talk through it a little bit from the story perspective. I'm not gonna go through a major synopsis reveal here. Safe to say that the Doctor and Amy and Rory arrive on this 22nd century island with a, they call it a monastery, but it looks like a classic castle to me.
Did you recognize it?
No, I was going to ask you, is that a real one?
It's not. It is a real castle, but I wondered if you recognized it, because one of the things, at least in the first episode, sort of more focused on some of the extraneous elements of the story, I was aware of the fact that it looked very familiar. And I live near it. It's over the hill from me. I'm in Cardiff, and it's Caerphilly Castle. But I've never been to it. It's actually because it appeared in Vampires of Venice. Okay. And I also wondered if I saw part of it in Amy's Choice. I wondered if they were reusing a bit of the set in Amy's Choice. That was an aside.
Okay,
I wondered if it seemed over familiar to anyone else.
Pity. It's a pity. I was hoping it was actually on an island. That'd be so cool. But it did, you know, it did look, when they showed the shot and I looked at that, and I go, that is awfully good for a CGI shot. The castle itself.
They blended it, and they placed that shot so that it gave the whole thing that feel.
But you know,
they placed it at the opening of both episodes.
It was just so good. I mean, I would think back to The Mind of Evil or all these other old Doctor Who stories where, for no obvious reason, they put some incongruous thing, a prison, a factory, whatever, in a castle, an old wrecked up castle. It just had such a classic Doctor Who feel to it that it I was immediately predisposed to like it.
And here's another thing about this series, as opposed to previous series of New Who, in what was, I suppose, more of a departure for the new series. Well, I mean, we've come and gone from Earth, haven't we? In the Pertwee era, there was the whole UNIT saga. In Russell T Davies' stories, you'd maybe go forwards into the future, you'd go into the past, you tend to be around Earth, and every three or four episodes you'd come back to present-day Earth, you'd be on the Powell Estate or wherever. This series has just had such a different feel to it in that respect. Even when you're on Earth, so our Earth stories, we had the opening two-parter where, okay, we were in 69 and we were in Utah, and at least to Doctor Who, that's not the, mm-hmm. the usual run-of-the-mill Earth story. And then the pirate ship, mm-hmm. And again, apart from in Utah where there were some blue skies, it's always been nighttime. So when we've gone out to the pocket universe in The Doctor's Wife, the whole thing has been dark. It's been really dark, the colouring of the show. And then this is an Earth story, but it didn't feel like an Earth story. It could have been on any planet, right, apart from possibly the Dusty Springfield stuff. And again, you know, nighttime, really dark. You know, he's not offering any of that sort of soapy sort of sitcom stuff that you come back to the family and the familiar.
You know, I thought RTD was always talking about how, you know, grounding the people emotionally back to their family, and I'm not sure that I, you know, not everybody has got that kind of grounding. So I appreciate the fact that they don't need to run Amy back to visit her folks, or, you know, now she doesn't have to go back to visit Rory because she's got him with him. So I think that frees them up a little bit. Whether that's intentional or whether that's just a byproduct of this, I do like it. I mean, you know, somebody's traveling around with a doctor, they don't want to go home every couple of weeks. I just can't picture that, except maybe Tegan once in a while. But
I mean, it's not that I didn't enjoy the stories, but this is different, and I'm really enjoying this because it kicks the story up into a different gear. Because when you sort of keep switching back to the sort of domestic Earth stories, there, I don't know, it has a very different feel to it anyway.
You know, that's the one thing that I've always kind of would get into this with my dad. He always liked the Pertwee stories more because they were set on Earth, and I've heard, you know, John Pertwee say the same thing. It's more frightening if there's a Dalek in the loo instead of on some bizarre, far-off planet. And I've always kind of preferred not being in the present modern-day times. So that's been an argument that's been going on for forever, as long as Doctor Who's been around. I mean, if you go back to the earliest ones, they would kind of bounce back and forth between Earth and fanciful future, and it's just been going that way. So this is good. I completely agree. I think it's nice. You can go anywhere in time and space. Why would you keep coming back to London? You know, modern day. It just doesn't make any sense. So I'm with you. I think. I think I'm agreeing there. So anyway, in this castle, or monastery as they call it, which I suppose can technically be a castle, but it looks like a castle more than a religious building. There is a mining of acid. I like the story so much I'm not even gonna bring that one up and say what? How do you mine acid? Don't wanna know.
I don't care. I like that. Why does it? Where are they getting it from? How are they getting it? Where is it going?
Why
to?
Would it be on? An, you know, doesn't why would matter. It doesn't really matter. That's right. I agree. It doesn't really matter. It's just one of those. You need the acid for it to be extremely dangerous. But it's like, yeah, all right, fine. I don't care.
If they'd gone to some length to explain how all the cars ran on acid now or something, you'd be kind of sitting there thinking, cars running on acid.
Yeah.
Don't put, you know, pull the other one. Whereas you just say, oh, yeah, we pipe it off to the mainland. You think, yeah, right, okay, yeah, because, you know, they'll need their acid, won't they? Obviously.
But the reason they need their we have the problem is because this acid is so extremely dangerous that the workers were being killed at a rate of one per week, according to their dialogue. And so they have very intricate, I guess you could call them Waldos. Really, they are the flesh, a manipulated biological substance that can perfectly replicate a human operator. So it's essentially a telepresence. You harness yourself in, and your consciousness, more or less, is replicated, extended into these identical copies of you, and they work, and should one of them be harmed, they just disconnect and you wake up in your harness. It's a very safe and apparently effective way for them to do the work. The problem is that the doctor arrives with a solar tsunami hot on his heels, which the overload of power causes these flesh bodies to become independent of their original hosts, or operators, I guess would be the correct word. And they have all the memories and all of the attributes of the originals. And this is here's another kudo to this story. That's a great idea, to be able to talk about the morality or the humanity of these beings. I mean, everyone thinks they're less human, or that typical sort of prejudice role, but they really aren't. And, or are they? In a couple places, maybe a little bit, but...
Well, this was one of the things where I had great concerns about the first episode. What direction were they going in with that? I would say the duplicate notion keeps popping up in Doctor Who stories.
Yes.
Has done since forever. I can remember, companions and doctors playing doubles of themselves. Two problems with duplicate stories. Normally, I hate them. There's one of the Dalek stories, Relegation of the Dalek or something, where they get duplicate humans and so forth.
Did you say Relegation of the Daleks?
Relegation of the Daleks, yeah, it's one of those, isn't it? Is it that... an R. Yeah, but it's the one where you get duplicates, but I mean, it's not new, and they've had it in the new series, because in the Sontaran Stratagem, they clone Martha. And the problem for me is, there's always, in my mind, a question about, okay, how does this work? How do you actually come up with a complete physical, molecular replica of a person? And then also, at the same time, what about the memories, the consciousness, how, given our level of knowledge about how the mind works, well, how can you justify that's going to come across? And of course, you can't spend 45 minutes explaining how mind transfer and body mm-hmm. photocopying is going to work. But for me, this gave it a good enough spin for me to sort of fill in the gaps with my imagination. So the idea of this living flesh that with dividing cells and the harness, mental link for controlling it, all that. That ticked that box as far as I was concerned.
Yeah. You don't really care whether it is viable to work. It actually makes sense why you would have this technology, and it makes sense if it were viable and why somebody would want to use it. So,
it gives you some principles on which, you can base it. And this is my other bugbear with some of these stories. You get the sense that they don't even have a clear idea. It's not just how it could happen, it's actually what the effects are. Mm-hmm. Is it just a purely physical copy, or is it a mental, does it share memories, does it share personality? They're really interesting questions, but they often don't surface until the resolution of the story, where the doctor has to appeal to the innate trace of humanity within the clone in order to stop them from shooting everyone or whatever it is, and suddenly the rules change. Well, none of that with this one. It right. took it head on.
And one of the things that, if you go back and look at other duplicate stories, virtually all of them, and I'm saying that just totally off the top of my head because I haven't counted them, but from memory, the purpose of making a duplicate, for whatever reason, is always to be an imposter and an infiltrator.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
this wasn't.
Right.
This actually had a reason. Why would you want to make one? It's because I don't want to die in a vat of acid doing this dangerous job.
And but also, it's not a plot device. It's a device to explore identity.
Yes.
And what it means to be you, in effect. And so, the question of were these gangers actually properly the same person they were a replica of, or were they not? That was the question at the core of the story.
And I'm not entirely sure that the answer at the end is yes, they were. But in any case, we should say that because these gangers are created and achieve stable form and consciousness, the story becomes a sort of, I would say, an us versus them, because that's what they keep saying. But really, it's an us versus us battle. The disgust that the humans have for the fake copies of themselves, and part of that is because their technology, but I think part of it is because how would you feel if someone had all of your memories and thoughts? And at the same time, these gangers think and act like the original people. The original people can be motivated to want to destroy the gangers. Therefore, it's only logical that the gangers can be motivated by their own sense of survival to feel they need to destroy their original humans. And so you have a kind of both sides have a good argument for a good argument within the confines of the story, not saying that prejudice is ever a good argument. And there stands the doctor, or I should say, the doctors, making the... Uh-oh.
I should turn my phone off, sorry.
Your phone makes a sonic screwdriver sound. That's quite...
Only when my brother's ringing.
As always, to make... The doctors are there to make the moral point that they should be at peace with each other. It was a very classic doctor peacemaker role. I know we talked about, well, I don't know if we talked about it, but Ben and I talked about it with the Silurian story last year, where that was, you know, that was John Pertwee again, doing the, you know, we ought to come to an agreement, we ought to come to an agreement. So there was kind of that feel in it. And when I say the doctors, somehow a ganger of the doctor is made and comes to life so that we can discover whether the doctor's a bigger man than the humans are.
Well, that was one of the things that I was worried about in the first episode. What is it about the gangers that makes them identify, if they believe that they are themselves, in effect, exactly the same as their replica? They have the same memories, they have the same thing for breakfast, they have the same kids, they have the same grandparents, mm-hmm. all of this. What is it that suddenly makes them more closely identified with other ganger versions of themselves than with their own duplicate or with anyone else?
I'm guessing tribalism, basically.
Well, it happens very suddenly, and I was concerned about this in the first episode. I wasn't quite sure how this would play out, and in particular, there's a moment where after the the original Cleave comes down with the bolty gun fiery thing, mm-hmm. and shoots the Marshall Lancaster character
Buzzer,
and they and the rest of them all run out and go, oh, the nasty human's going to turn on us. At that point, Jenny becomes like the leader of the flesh, saying, you know, we've got to turn, and it's very strong, and it's a very sudden turn after she's developed this bond with Rory that, you know, is much more about her. About him taking her as a person, not about, mm-hmm. So there's a real sort of sudden turnaround there that I wasn't sure was justified in story terms, having seen the second part, it did seem to me that the reason for that was actually much more clearly to do with the weakness in her character. And that's partly because of the strength of the way that some of the other characters responded to it, where they bonded much more strongly with their human or ganger equivalents. What was the chap's name with the 5-year-old son?
Jimmy.
Jimmy, there you go. So Jimmy, for example, had that... there was that lovely exchange in the first episode about it being their son's birthday. Mm-hmm. And then by the end of the first episode, they had become enemies. But in the second episode, that bond reemerges. And... sorry, go on.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say, I think you're dead on. I think Jennifer, in her little story with Rory, where she talks about being a weak child and red wellies, and that I think that's a sign of, and I might be reading too much into it, but I mean I think that's a sign of self-doubt. I mean, she as the people go, she's probably the least self-confident of the people. She's probably got a poorer self-image, and as such, well, that may be the personality flaw that leads to the, you know, if you were the people who are like that are those who tend to dream of being superheroes and having special powers to get even with other people that they see wrongs in their life. So here she is now; she's become something which we see ultimately is malleable enough to be more than human. So it's kind of like, you know, absolute power corrupts absolutely. They've just given her a little something to make her unique and different, and she runs with it in the wrong way. But I think that's, I think it is her personality that triggers that failure. And I'd like to think the writer
I think it's great writing. And I think that is the reading of it. And I think you kind of need to see the whole, but the both parts of the story to put that together. Although it is all there in the first part, mm-hmm. It's just in retrospect, it's easier to see how it all fits together.
Yeah, yeah. And Rory, you know, at the very end of the episode, a first episode, abandons him to go rescue Jen after he hears her scream, which, you know, could have been anything, but we now know that's when she was killed, or fatally wounded anyway, in the story, and that, you know, Jen's really not in the second one at all. It's strictly Ganger the whole way. So, you know, it just feels like the guy put the pieces together very well. Just yeah. Very well put together in that episode. And like I say, even the things that just kind of set aside that I wrote down here that didn't quite have an answer. The rest of it was so well put together, and some of them I actually think might have further ramifications. I think there may be more to this story later on than just a standalone story that fit nicely in the arc. So the duplicate doctor, nice to see him have a few reminding scenes of and dialogue from past doctors as he tries to come to grips with his 900 years of imparted memory.
Reverse the polarity of the jelly babies.
Yeah. And it's interesting that they quoted Hartnell and Pertwee in, you know, someday I'll come back, that kind of, will I come back, someday we'll come back, for when Susan left, and the reverse of polarity of the neutron flow. But then when they went to Tom Baker, they actually used Tom Baker's voice. Would you like a jelly baby? Yeah, go back and watch it.
Good, great. Well, I haven't had time to rewatch this episode.
And then
a couple more.
He says something else. I think he says, then reverse the polarity of the jelly baby. And then he goes, hello, I'm the doctor. And it's David Tennant's voice. And it's not an imitation. They've actually lifted those two lines and thrown them in. I don't know why they didn't use the other doctor's voices, though. It's kind of odd. It was a nice scene, you know, typical. They threw something in for the fans. But I enjoyed that one because it made sense in the context of the story too. What about a question for you? Psychic paper, wasn't it destroyed in an earlier episode recently? Towards the end of last year?
Do you know that rings a bell? And I can't put my finger on it.
Because we haven't seen it for a while, and then it just popped up in this one, Psychic Paper, again.
Yeah.
I thought it was destroyed towards the end of last year. But I couldn't be bothered to look online. But I wrote it down. Wasn't that destroyed? You know, it's the interesting thing about the Psychic Paper while I'm thinking about it. In Classic Who, the Doctor arrives, things go wrong, what happens? The Doctor gets blamed for it. And, you know, while the bad guy continues to do whatever he's doing, the Doctor is being blamed for it, being chased up and down corridors. The Psychic Paper eliminates that. It gives the Doctor enough credentials that at no point did they think he was the cause of this going wrong.
And, yeah.
And I never...
That's not new. I mean, Power of the Daleks, for example, he turns up and he tells them he's the examiner. So he has the credentials.
But he had credentials there, yes. The few times that he has credentials. But in the vast majority of episodes, he's got no papers, no explanation how he got there, no nothing. The Psychic Paper is kind of a shorthand to get him out of that. We'll just blame the Doctor for everything. And we haven't had as much of that in New Who. That's not common. And
maybe partly because 45-minute episodes, there's
could be
less chance for him to be hanging around in prison cells.
But if they're like this, they should all be two-parters. But then I think I've said that more than once. The 45 minutes just isn't enough. And I think even if you have to artificially contrive a cliffhanger.
Are we getting more? Are we getting more two-parters this year?
I think so.
Are we getting another two-parters in the next six episodes?
I think technically the next one is going to be a two-parter.
Yeah, I guess it is.
In my opinion, it's a two-parter.
We'll have the cliffhanger, and then we'll have the resolution in the autumn.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's got to be a good thing. I mean, for me, I thought that the Doctor's wife. That could have been a two-parter. It could have been expanded.
I think that most of the criticisms that Ben and I had, and I, you know, based on your feedback on it, I mean, we liked that episode. We did like it. It's just that it was a lot of, you know, the story that you're talking about, the emotional bonding and the dialogue in Mother TARDIS was a very minor part of that story. Of that 45 minutes, I mean, it was the core piece of it, but everything around it, there was more around than there was the meat of the story. And yes, two-parter, that would have been much better. You know, if they had spent more time building the TARDIS, as I said, if they'd had more than 18 minutes to build this TARDIS, they would have had more than 18 minutes to talk.
It would have been a better story.
Yes, and I think it would have been. Could have been a truly awesome story in that way. So, you know, two-part, great, fine. I'm happy with it. I don't agree with the notion that when they brought Who back, it said, yeah, kids today can't watch more than 45 minutes of TV without playing video games. It's just not true. You know, they won't wait. Yes, they will. My kids, you know, sit there and Michelle with a pillow over her and...
Well, yeah, let me ask you about that, because I was think this was going through my mind. Another thing about this series of Doctor Who in particular, another sort of change that has come in is it is just getting scarier and scarier. And the scenes at the very opening of this, you know, the guy's arm, before you know what's going on, you see the guy, his arm melts and then his face.
Mm-hmm. Did
your kids just, does this...
No, doesn't bother them. They wasn't bothered, didn't appear to be bothered by it at all. But I'll tell you what did bother them. The silence. My daughter spent weeks, you know, wouldn't go in the bathroom by herself. with this, and not because of the woman that got destroyed by the science, but just because they could be there and she doesn't know that they're there. She does, you know, while watching it, she's tucked up, you know, with a pillow in the chair with her feet up off the ground in a sort of curled up position. But no, I don't really see any terrorized, but I wasn't like that as a kid. That stuff didn't bother me. A few things did. Oh, vampires. And,
well, I was scared by Peter Davison era Who, so you can imagine if
the gravis.
If I had a time machine and went back in time with some of these Stephen Moffat episodes, then I would just be a gibbering psychopath by now.
I mean, more so than
just as well. I mean, I coped with that okay, and a couple of weeks after the Silence episode, that corridor in the episode, supposed to be in the West Wing, well, that's at work, so I was in that corridor, and had I been of a more delicate disposition, I would probably have been very worried about it. What he does so brilliantly is the things like the clockwork men under the bed, the statues that you can't see moving, the crack in the wall, these incredibly scary looking monsters that you can see and then seconds later not remember that you've seen. So you could have seen one, and that's what's so incredibly clever about the way, you know, he is setting out to scare these kids.
And the funny thing is,
he's really good at this.
And the funny thing is, it's like, so Michelle is like, well, it could be the silence. And I'm like, okay, let me ask you this question then. You can't see them. Yeah? You can't remember them. They're not going to do anything to you. What are you worried about? it doesn't help.
Yeah, no, exactly. It doesn't help. That's what's so brilliant about it. But yeah, he's neatly bypassed now any hope that parents might have of reassuring the kids.
Yeah. So the... in this episode, we have the two doctors, the doctor and Smith, I guess we can call him, and we get to watch Amy's dynamic with these two doctors, who are identical.
Yeah, we also get to see Matt Smith's dynamic acting with himself. I mean, that was a lovely performance.
Yes, it was well done, and obviously technically very good, because you're acting, you know, not with yourself, with yourself, if that makes any sense. You know, he was a little, so I've complained, he's a little bit wacky, and I'm not sure, I think they've taken his wackiness a little too far, so a lot of the scenes with himself, he was kind of in double wacky mode, but it wasn't too bad. So it was a very nice performance.
It was well pitched. The finishing his own set, you know, the finishing his own sentences, and yeah, but you were thinking that, yes, but it's just so inspiring to hear myself say it.
Yes, all
that. The nice little lines, but he's so relaxed about it. He's just so laid back in the performance. It just felt so natural.
Yeah,
I thought
he probably
really
talks to himself a lot.
Yeah,
so, you know. but there's a trick there. The doctor conveniently lost his shoes in the first part after he'd been scanned by the flesh, and so we have the two doctors: one in the replacement shoes, quote unquote, the real doctor, and the one in the replica shoes, the ganger doctor. And we watch as Amy does not react well to the ganger doctor. I thought that was a very good performance on Karen Gillan's part too, because she was, you know, pitched somewhere between you're not the real doctor, and I kind of agree with her. I mean, there is one that is the original print, and there is one that is not. And you're pretty amazing, but yet, you know, she still has this sort of emotional bond with the first one and not the second one, which is, you know, is the way people are. It's not necessarily the best our best trait, but it was part of what it's part of our humanity too, unfortunately. And I thought that was well played. Of course, it's all a trick. The doctors had swapped shoes, but anyway,
it was a nice thing to explore because you get to consider how exactly how identical would the two doctors have to be in order for there to be that kind of relationship. And obviously, that was what the Doctor was himself playing with. Even though in this case, we do have a distinct, detectable difference between the original and the Ganger version, there's no way of knowing it unless you have some kind of hint or a sonic screwdriver.
Well, you know, that's the other thing. So, identical. They're identical, right? But then we keep saying that they're identical, they're identical, they're identical, and yet the Doctor can tell them apart by sonic screwdriver, which means they're not identical. Furthermore, Jen can't operate the machine with her handprint. It says non-human access denied, something like that.
Yeah.
So there's something that even 22nd century Earth technology can differentiate between the gangers.
Yes, it can tell its flesh.
So they're not truly identical in every sense of the word. And so, you know, again, you get kind of down to the question of identity, because these people, these almost people, are going to diverge a little bit. You may have stamped an identical copy in the mind and more or less in the body, but they follow different experiences. They're going to deviate from each other as time goes by.
It's following there's been this theme of you know, what does it mean to be not to be human, but to be a person and mm-hmm. to be alive, and it's taking that a bit further. Now I've got a question, because I, for various reasons, I got to see this when it got aired originally, and then I haven't had a chance to watch it again mm-hmm. To this moment. When we were watching it, I missed a line, but the people I was watching it caught me up on it. In the TARDIS, at the end, when the gangers come into the TARDIS, mm-hmm. the Doctor says the TARDIS has done something to them.
Said it's the TARDIS energy has stabilized the...
So he's stabilized the copies.
Yeah.
Right.
No, so they're permanent.
They'd interpreted it as it made them proper people, as it were, that it has somehow made them human. But they would still be identifiable as being flesh.
I'm guessing that, but they won't keep shifting back into the muddy white form. I think they're
good.
They're
that's me happy then, because I was worried that the story itself had somehow endorsed the viewpoint that only the actual human is a genuine person.
Whereas
that's not the case here.
Now, I never thought I'd say this, but I'm going to. How good was Rory in this story?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, if that wasn't his, Arthur Darvill, but the character of Rory as well. I mean, apart from stupid mistake, but a human mistake, he was, you know, far superior as a companion to the Doctor than many, if not all, of the previous New Who companions. I was thinking that as I walked through it. I thought, you know, he's empathetic. He's taking a moral position that to do better, to work with the Doctor. He's you know, not questioning the humanity of these people. If the Doctor thinks so, then you know he's probably right. And even if he isn't, they're still hurting, And
yeah, and, well, he's I think he's stronger than that. He's identifying it for himself. There is something he's identifying. You do see it, and again, I think this is deliberate, and I think it's another layer of the really nice writing we're getting here. But you get the identification from Auton Rory there that there is an understanding of being a person, but not.
Yeah, that's
you
true.
That it's not about your the you know, whatever the defining the characteristics, whatever on a molecular level the distinguishing features might be, but it's not about that. And it's about the feelings that mm-hmm. this girl has, and so that he builds that real empathy with her, and then he totally stands up for it. He's really admirable, I think, in this.
Yeah, and the Rory Amy dynamic was good too. I mean, this is probably the first time I've seen them interact in a proper adult fashion, and not just Amy kind of beating up on him. I mean, you can see she's a little bit jealous, but at the same time, you know, there's a sort of go ahead, you know, I know you're helping another person look to it when Jen's, you know, crying on his shoulders. I mean, they really kind of have come into themselves as two people, ironically. In this case, but because of course one of them isn't.
At least one of them.
At least one of them isn't. That's right. Perhaps more, which is the big reveal at the end of the episode. Throughout this episode, we are shown that the Doctor is here for a reason. He was trying to get rid of Rory and Amy at the beginning of the episode when the tsunami brought them there. He knows something about the flesh. He knows that it's an early form of technology. And at the end of the episode, in the TARDIS, he reveals what's going on. And that is that he was there researching the flesh because, dun-dun-dun, Amy is a flesh avatar. She is not the real Amy. She doesn't know that. And oddly enough, she's not stabilized by the TARDIS energy, but and he dissolves her at the end of the episode.
Yes, bit harsh, I thought maybe.
You know, but
I took notes when I was watching when I rewatched the first episode, and I was making. I thought the fish and chips thing at the beginning, I thought, well, okay, that's interesting. There's something there. But I thought maybe it was just crowbarred in something that was going to be a reveal coming in the mid-season finale. But no, it wasn't. Because I thought, you know, they've been pushed off course by a solar storm. It could have nothing to do with what the Doctor had in mind. But no, it was a device for doing something he didn't want to get them involved with. And yet he got stuck with them, mm-hmm. which was nicely done, I thought. That was nicely done. But I also got a big note, you know, what, from that first episode, what does the Doctor know? There are all these hints through there that he knows something about the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, right, are they going to answer this in the second episode? Of course, all the way through the second episode, you don't get anything more about that. You get more questions because he's obviously, we've got both of him being very confident about each other, so you still think he knows something about it. Mm-hmm. It's not until that moment that you know the reveal is there, and it really comes as quite a shock.
Wasn't expecting that. I fully agree. And you and I have discussed our predictions, which, you know, we don't even need to go into because they're wrong.
Well, you see, my prediction was to do with the fact that. In the first episode, I thought they were setting up for the Doctor. The Doctor, after the storm, the Doctor and indeed everyone else is unconscious for an hour. And we know that during that time, some of the gangers become end up in different places. And so some of the gangers and some of the humans are together, but they all think they're humans. So the gangers don't realize they're gangers and... so forth. Mm-hmm. And the Doctor himself has been unconscious. And it just seemed to me a big pointer that, okay, the Doctor that we're getting there, he's not really the Doctor. And the point about it was, I thought, I mean, apart from the fact they were signalling the fact that at the end we were going to discover that, you know, there is a gang of Doctor, and I thought it was going to be the one that we saw all along, it was also going to underline the fact that the gangers are, you know, to all intents and purposes, they are identical. Mm-hmm. And as far as we'd been concerned, we'd been following the real Doctor, and then, oh, it turned out to be a ganger. And, of course, I now know the reason why they didn't pull that storyline in the first episode. It's because that was the shoe reveal in the second storyline, fooling Amy instead of fooling us, mm-hmm. Or as well as fooling us. But I was pleased it was there.
I mean,
there was all that signalling for it, and I would have felt very let down if it hadn't pulled it out in the end.
I'm still hopeful because the doctor did make a mention when the ganger doctor self-sacrifices himself and melts himself down to destroy the monster Jennifer has mutated into. You know, the other doctor says, "Well, the memory goes on in the Matrix, and there's always hope." And the soon to be melted doctor says, "Well, if I come back and nick your biscuits, you'll know if you were right." So I think there's a possibility still that we're going to see a ganger doctor return. And
yeah,
I'm hoping that that's the one that got shot.
I think I would feel that was an enormous cheat because Canton Delaware, what's his name, the thingy, the elder, says, in response to Amy's question, is he a clone, is he a duplicate, is he anything like this? He said, no, he is the Doctor.
How would he know?
Yeah.
And didn't we just spend the whole episode discussing what does make him the Doctor? I mean, the Doctor said that's the Doctor.
Well, yeah, it's true. But the point, that line is there because we need to know in that episode that what we've seen is the Doctor, and it is the Doctor that has died.
Mm.
And if the resolution to that, if the way in which that ends up actually being sorted out is, oh no, he was just the duplicate, oh, it's the duplicate getting killed again, that's not going to do it for me. I'm going to feel a bit let down.
So I have a question for you. At what point did the Doctor swap shoes?
Now, that was interesting. I don't know.
I watched it.
And I was going to look for that when I rewatched it.
I watched it through the second time, and I didn't figure it out. Now, the first scene where the two are standing up and they're saying, you know, he's asking about cybermats and saying, I'm just having to verify that you're really real. And then they kind of say, okay, so we've got a plan of attack. Yes, we do. Like this. And then they rush off. And I kind of watched that, and I said, you know, maybe that's the course of action that they're talking about, is that they're going to swap their shoes. But they certainly don't have the time to do it at that moment, because they run off immediately into the next crisis. So somewhere there, they swap. Maybe when they're behind the console, I don't know. But I think it's clear it's the real Doctor that slams Amy up against a wall and is violent towards her, which was odd.
Except that he knows she's the Flesh. Now, I need to watch that again, because that was one of the key scenes. As soon as the episode finished, my question was, has Amy told the Doctor he's going to die?
Yes.
As in, the Doctor.
Absolutely she did. Because he said...
Because that was him.
He made the line at the end when the other Doctor was holding the door. He said something about dying, and the real Doctor says, unless you've received an invitation. And so he definitely heard Amy talk about the invitation. So he knows. For sure. So, I don't know. So
One of the other things, I mean, I keep going on about the changes in Doctor Who that we've seen. And obviously you've got a new showrunner taking over. I kind of think last series, that was pretty much Moffat taking the Russell T Davies template for the show, and putting his own stamp on it. He took what was there and went with it. This is now getting into more his own thing, and one of the things about it is it's rapidly becoming so much more complicated that you need to rewatch the episodes just to get what has happened in that past episode. And then you get a reveal like this in this episode, and you think, well, not only do I... This is why I'm so desperate to rewatch The Almost People and possibly The Rebel Flesh again, but not only that, I actually think I need to watch the whole of this series again. I need to go... And in particular, I need to go back and watch the opening two-parter again, because... When did Amy get swapped?
Well, now,
Dr. Schultz.
I wanted to talk to you about that at the end of the podcast, because this leads into crazy theory time. I just have a couple of points to make before we talk about that. I think we both agree we like this episode, right? It's all right. It's okay.
Oh, yes. I think we can. That motion is passed.
Did you notice that the company name, Morpeth Jetson, was rather pronounced in the episode? That it was like labeled all the stuff, that she actually mentioned it in dialogue, that it was on the boardroom door.
Yeah, there's a logo and everything.
There's a logo and everything. They went to a lot of work to develop a company, and I think we're going to see Morpeth Jetson again.
Actually, I tell you what, we're going to see Cleve again, aren't we?
Maybe.
I mean, Raquel Cassidy was so fab. I mean, first episode, I was racking my brains, and I knew I'd seen her in Moving Wallpaper, and I was thinking, now, where else have I seen her? And, of course, she was in Party Animals with Matt Smith. They're this really... I don't know if you've seen the show, but it's... I watched it when he was cast, because it was one of the major series he'd done, and they had this really nice relationship going, where she was like a mentor figure to him. The first episode of this, I was kind of thinking, I've seen her somewhere, where was it? And thinking, oh, that's interesting. Second episode, I just thought she was fantastic in this. And that character was pivotal in reshaping the allegiances between the characters and between the gangers and the humans, mm-hmm. and then between each other. And I'd like, if you're right about that, and it hadn't occurred to me now, but if you're right about that, I think it's very possible that she could come back. I'd like to see her again, if your prediction's correct.
The other thing is, when Buzzer actually knocked the so-called ganger doctor out and left him behind, and then the ganger people found him, they knew he was a ganger. But obviously they didn't, because he wasn't. So they assumed he was a ganger. So, you know, do the gangers have a ganger sense? Or do they have ganger radar? Apparently it doesn't work. But...
I guess they... Would it be consistent to say... Again, I need to rewatch it. Would it be consistent to say they don't have any recognition of gangers anywhere else?
I think that's true, or maybe somebody would have spotted Amy, although she's more advanced ganger technology.
Yeah, true. There's always that guess out. But then maybe they have some reason to believe that the Doctor is a ganger in that scene.
You also notice that it didn't really
Why is he left there?
It didn't really seem necessary for the extra Doctor to be holding the door at the end. Because she wasn't really bad. You know, for a long time he was hugging Amy, and Cleve was hanging onto the door just fine. So, and since the whole thing was going to blow up, you know, it just seemed like we just had to dissolve the Doctor. Okay. So, okay, let's talk Amy. When did they swap Amy? I think it was back towards the Pandorica. I'm thinking it was way back towards the Pandorica. And it was done before Amy was abducted by the Silence, because she was already seeing Eyepatch Lady before they kidnapped her.
Precisely. She sees it as she comes. She sees her for the first time as she comes into the room in which she is then kidnapped.
Later kidnapped. And, you know, that's the room where we see the baby pictures and stuff. And that all is the one thing that's really going to bother me about this whole story arc, is we're obviously playing very, very fast and loose with timelines. Because Amy's obviously had the baby, and if the kid's nine-ish, then that was 1960. Or the kid, you know, has been in the orphanage for a long time, so, you know, it's prior to 1969. How did Amy get to prior to 1969? The flesh is obviously future technology. We know that the silence is tied to those TARDIS-like things. There aren't many people in the universe that could try to build a TARDIS. I think it has to be a Time Lord. I think there has to be a Time Lord doing this. Whoever blew up the TARDIS, whoever, in all these pieces, I can imagine, can imagine the Master creating Morpeth Jetson to build the technology, to make the Flash, to do the and have some sort of ability to travel through time to do these things. I don't know if why would he want to make a Time Lord girl? Repopulate the race? Maybe.
I don't know. I can't cope with all of these strands at once.
Yeah,
there's a problem.
A new body for himself?
Should be. But there's a problem in here.
Oh, I'm sure there's lots.
with that theory, because I've got two theories about when Amy gets swapped. One is that she does get swapped in Day of the Moon somehow, but that it happens prior to her going into that room, or there's something about that sequence there where.
The cliffhanger at the end that we never see the resolution of?
No. I haven't thought about that. But I think about during Day of the Moon that somehow, although she goes into the orphanage, at some point she is kidnapped, and it's before she appears to be kidnapped. I haven't quite worked out how that works, but I'll tell you the reason for that, and that's because if it's any earlier, why hasn't she seen Eye Patch Lady any earlier? We see her regularly seeing Eye Patch Lady from the point at which, we know why that is now, and it's because she's been kidnapped. Mm-hmm. So if she was kidnapped earlier, why didn't we see that? My second theory is slightly more radical than yours, and it goes back to Amy's choice.
Mm-hmm.
Because we've got some similar things going on about dreaming here. We've possibly got an adversary that could reappear in some way.
I kind of hope not on that one, I have to say. I thought the Dream Lord was... he's a nice standalone piece, but I don't see that one as having legs for coming back too many times.
Raise the possibility.
Yeah.
But here's my problem with both yours and my theory, and that is, in the Big Bang, the rest of the universe gets destroyed, apart from that tiny corner of time and space, which contains Amy and the Doctor and Rory. So if there's a second Amy somewhere else that's controlling that version of Amy, and the Avatar version of Amy, where can that somewhere be, given that there is nowhere else at that point? The rest of space and time doesn't exist.
The TARDIS?
The TARDIS is in the middle of an explosion.
But wasn't River in that explosion? And she was intact for a while. And whatever blew the TARDIS up kind of talked to her from the TARDIS, so maybe that's where it was sheltering? I don't know.
Well, it's possible, but then we have got another angle. She's in the TARDIS somewhere.
So, I don't know. You know, next week we're supposed to find out, this is the day we find out who River Song is, and I don't have a good feeling on that one. I don't think that one's gonna, it's gonna pay off the way I, the way it's been built up to pay off too, but we'll see. I suspect, I really do suspect that there will still be pieces of this story that don't fit logically together. Even when it's all been laid out on the table and said, here you go, here's the picture, I suspect a few of the pieces will still be forced into place. And you just have to kind of ignore them and say, oh,
well,
yeah.
One of the things we know from last season's resolution is that he doesn't tie up all the pieces. Not that he's not tying them up, he's keeping them in play.
Mm-hmm.
So there are all these pieces here we're trying to fit together in the resolution. I think one thing we can predict for certainty is some of these pieces are staying in play, particularly with the second half of the season still to come. We're going to get some answers, but we're going to get more questions than answers, and we're going to get questions that we've got now. We're still going to have questions in a week's time.
So is Rory still an Auton?
That's our question. We don't know.
They've issued what they call their non-spoiler photos for the next episode. You know, shows Cybermen. But, I mean, more importantly, it shows Rory in
Which
a Roman
I would
outfit.
That's a spoiler.
I'd heard
that one, but I think there should be a warning there.
And Moffat has even come out and said that's not a spoiler. Anything that we put out on the BBC page is not a spoiler. You will not get...
But it is.
I
it's just an officially sanctioned spoiler. It's still a spoiler.
Well, I suppose. I suppose. But, you know, so is the trailer for next week's episode, too.
Yeah, sure. But they didn't have that.
They didn't have that. That's very interesting. You have to go to the website to see it. It is there.
I haven't been on the website, didn't know it was there. I'm going to not go to the website and see that, because I don't want to see it.
There's a prequel for the next episode.
I might watch the prequel.
And there's a trailer, which, you know, just doesn't really say anything. I think you may see the Cybermen in it, if I recall correctly. I watched it, and I was like, oh yeah, okay, this is just kind of... You know, scenes from stuff's happening, and the Doctor's going to go to war. Ho ho! You know, kind of thing.
But we after the Christmas invasion. After the Christmas Carol, we had the series, so-called Series 6 trailer, featuring all these clips. Now, I haven't been back to look at it, but pretty much all those clips. They actually turned out to be clips of Episode 1, I think. So he's fairly good at packing quite a lot into a trailer without
telling you
giving anything away.
There are a few scenes from that trailer that were not in Episode 1. There was the gangers in their suits in the castle. There's a shot of them walking down the hallway.
Yep.
There's that creepy, I think it's Matt Smith in a clown outfit, sitting on a bed. And there was a monstrous face thing that was roaring at people. And I think those are the only things I recall from the trailer that have not yet shown up. And none of that was in the trailer for the next episode.
Well, yeah. I guess we're still going to have some questions.
Yeah. You know, there is River saying, this is the day the Doctor finds out who I am. But they've been saying that for forever. So, I think that's...
The ending of this one, and you say the Doctor goes to war, it's called A Good Man Goes to War. Did it remind you a teeny weeny bit of the end of Bad Wolf? So at the end of Bad Wolf, the cliffhanger... I mean, in this one, obviously, the cliffhanger is the fairly shocking... Amy turns out to be somewhere completely else than she realises, this sinister white patch lady, all that. But it's still that thing of the Doctor telling Rose over the video comms when she's been captured by the Daleks, I'm coming to get you. And rather than it being the cliffhanger being the monsters threatening the Doctor, it's actually the Doctor threatening the monsters. Or maybe that's just me.
I guess there was some similarity. I consistent with how the Doctor would behave to a companion, though. You know, I would never abandon you to the aliens. So that's probably Adric.
He tells Amy, "I'm coming to get you," just in the same way that he tells Rose, "I'm coming to get you." Although, in that case, he's talking to her over a video monitor rather than talking to her through a flesh avatar.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I see it. There's another tie into the Bad Wolf. I don't know if you caught this. I would have kissed the TV screen had they done this. But the just to be mean, I mean, just to be cruel, when Cleve reveals her password to be Bad Boy, oh, if it had been Bad Wolf, I would have tittered with glee. You know, not thinking it would go anywhere, but just thinking somebody had been, you know, paying attention to the past and said, "Well, I think I'll just have a little fun with this and we'll call it Bad Wolf," and, you know, thumb our noses.
That would have caused a meltdown, I think. Yeah, the four of us would have been alive. I mean, as it is, I think their hackers are going to have a field day, because they now know that anyone who watches Doctor Who, they can get into their accounts and their emails and everything just by using that password.
Well, I think we're probably both looking forward to next week then, right?
Oh, yes.
And I...
Yes. It'd better deliver, but...
It's a two-parter. It's two-parter, and we're going to be months seeing the conclusion.
The thing I'm more frightened of than in not answering the questions is it answers them, and I don't like the answers. I'd much rather it just, you know, we kept some of the questions in play and I could carry on being happy. I hope we do get some answers, but I hope I like them.
That's right. I don't want the answers if I'm not going to enjoy them.
Absolutely, yeah.
So...
They can be challenging, but they better not be trite. But they won't be. I trust Stephen Moffat. He has done such a lot of good this season and last season. But, you know, you think he can't get any better? Well, I think, yeah.
We will find out. We will find out next time. Now, you know, I don't know. I don't know whether we're going to do the next episode on Fusion Patrol or we're going to save it for... for September, or whenever the next the other half of that comes. I guess it'll just depend on what happens on the episode.
If it's anything like this, you're going to have you're probably going to have to rewatch the whole series again, and there'll probably be enough in there to keep you speculating.
Yeah. Well, I want to remind everyone that you can reach us at feedback@FusionPatrol. Join us in our forums at FusionPatrol.com. Visit us on Facebook at, well, Fusion Patrol. And or follow us on Twitter and find out what I had for lunch today at Fusion Patrol. And we hope to hear from you. And Simon, I appreciate you coming in and getting a chance to chat about the episode. I know we had an issue with Ben not being available in a timely fashion this week, but I also know that you wanted to talk a little bit about how great the season's been so far compared to our review, so we wanted to give you that chance.
I'm only slightly disappointed that you actually like this one so much. I couldn't actually correct you on the one we were talking about, but...
Well, then you came in on the right episode. You came in on the really good episode that we can all agree on. And I hope everyone will join us again next time on Fusion Patrol.
You've been listening to the Fusion Patrol podcast, a production of Lone Locust Productions. Join us on our new discussion forums at FusionPatrol.com. Find us on Facebook
or follow us on Twitter, username Fusion Patrol. You can also send us feedback by email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. If you'd like to support Fusion Patrol, please leave us a review on iTunes. Fusion Patrol's theme music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. I'm putting this one under potential spoilers here after the credits, so turn off now. We don't know anything. This is totally not anything that we've found out. This is completely speculation. But it was strong enough that we thought, well, we'll tack it on the end. So if you don't want to know something that seems like a pretty good guess, turn it off now and we'll talk to you again in the next episode. And I'm gonna work out that name, Morpeth, Morphetjetsan, and think about that one for a while.
How can that be an anagram of the master?
Yes, how can that be an anagram of the master? And if the letters are there for master, there's at least those letters in that. Or we put down. I ran it through one of those internet anagram servers, and the first thing that came up was Phantom Jester. What do you think about that?
Phantom Jester, I think is that is too good a name for it not to be. Okay, I think you heard it here. You need to put spoiler tags around this. You heard it here first. Phantom Jester. And now I'm thinking the Dream Lord. It's much more. It's looking much more likely now.
It does. That does make me think of the Dream Lord. Although, you know, at the time we were, I think Ben and I were hoping that the Dream Lord would turn out to be the master. So it didn't work out that way.
Who's Russian dolls?
That's true. It's Russian dolls, and the Dream Lord was a manifestation basically inside the TARDIS, and so I don't know. The only anagram we could come up with that included the word master was Master Pet John, and that doesn't really make a lot of sense. So, I'm thinking, yeah, Phantom Jester, that's...
Phantom Jester, Matt Smith in the clown suit, the Dream Lord, I think we have a winner.
I think we have a winner there. I think we've sussed on to what Mr. Moffat is up to.